Hello, Shiver Seekers. Are you ready to follow us into the unknown? I'm Cynthia.
And I'm Stephanie. You have found the Dark Oak. In today's episode, we explore the bizarre story of the convicted serial killer, Kathleen Fulbig, and also the exonerated serial killer.
Oh, so this is unusual in a couple ways. We have a woman serial killer and then an exonerated serial killer, which I guess maybe only one can actually be true, but...
Yeah, well, I'll give you all the facts and then you tell me what you think.
Okay, I'm curious. Well, welcome to The Dark Oak, the mystery podcast with purpose. Each month through our charity called the Branch of Hope Foundation, we give a portion of earnings from our Patreon and sponsors to a nonprofit organization related to the first episode of the month. To find out how you can be a part of the movement, head over to thedarkoak.com or stay with us until the end of the episode and we will give you all of the details.
Thank you. All right, I'm kind of just going to get right into it. I will tell you, I've wanted to cover this case for quite a while. Ever since I heard about it, I said, that can't be real. It's incredible because Kathleen Fulbig, was basically the most hated woman in Australia for decades. And now, in recent news, just in the last few years, she's been completely exonerated. Now, I'm going to give you all the facts that helped actually convict her, and then I'll give you the new evidence, and then we'll kind of see where we end up here, because I don't really know how I feel about it after looking at all the evidence I was able to find. So I guess without further ado, we'll get into it.
Okay. I'm interested. I know nothing about this case, so I'm curious to see where I'm going to land.
You're going to be a little blown away, I think.
Okay.
Now, Kathleen's life was pretty much tragic from the beginning. It's kind of a sad start. In 1969, when she was only 18 months old, her father, Thomas John Britton, nicknamed Taffy, fatally stabbed her mother 24 times with a carving knife after becoming enraged when he felt that she wasn't paying enough attention to little toddler Kathleen. I mean, right out of the chute.
Okay. So strike one for violence does run in the family, I guess.
Violence does run in the family and also trauma.
Trauma. And also, wow, you're not paying enough attention to our toddler, so I'm going to stab you 24 times?
Yeah, listen to this. As he cradled his wife's bleeding body, after he'd just stabbed her 24 times, he leaned down to her and said, quote, I'm sorry, darling. I had to do it, end quote.
You've got me. I am a captive audience from this point on, Stephanie. Tell me more.
He then turned to a witness that later testified at his trial and said, quote, I had to do it. She was going to kill my child, end quote.
Did he feel like did she maybe have like postpartum depression or postpartum something else that made him feel his daughter was in actual danger?
I wish I could answer that question.
We don't know.
We don't know. However, what we do know is that Taffy Britton was a bit of a brute. He was a criminal and he often worked as an enforcer for like crime bosses.
Ew.
Yeah. So I think this was just kind of in his nature.
Okay, got it.
And he was well known for capping knees, breaking legs, putting his hands on his coworkers' throats. As a matter of fact, he had even slashed his first wife's neck, but somehow she survived. So somehow I feel like the blame would lean more towards Taffy and not on the behavior of Kathleen's poor mother.
Okay, I got it. Not that that would have been an appropriate way to handle it, even if he did feel she was unfit. But yeah, you're painting a picture for
me. Now, after Kathleen's father's conviction and incarceration, she was sent to live with an aunt. But not surprisingly, her behavior was described as detached, moody, volatile, and angry. She would often erupt with wild temper tantrums, and she was deemed unmanageable by her family. Which, I mean, sad face, right? She just went through a traumatic experience losing her mother and her father. So she was sent to live in an orphanage and then eventually a foster home. I'm just not really sure what people expected from her, really.
Well, we now know that that's, like you said, a very traumatic start to life. And she probably could have really used some help that wasn't available, I guess, back then, widely available. What is 1969, 1970?
Exactly.
Early 70s?
Yes, early 70s. Yeah. And her time at her foster home was mostly uneventful from what I can tell. Her foster mother did notice, again, that Kathleen didn't communicate her feelings very well. There were no doctors that they could turn to at this point because there weren't very many doctors that specialized in emotional trauma of children.
Sure.
And so, unfortunately, Kathleen was left to process a lot of this on her own.
And this is a lot to process. I mean, I struggle with just like, you know, just daily normal stuff. This is a lot.
This is a lot. Exactly. According to Kathleen, while her foster mother was kind, she was very strict and became more controlling as Kathleen grew older. And she allegedly would interrogate her about where she was going and who she was seeing, even though that, I don't know, that just sounds like a mother to me.
I was thinking my son would be like, yeah, she interrogates me because I want to know where you are and who you're with.
But again, this is viewed through Kathleen's eyes, and she just didn't, she didn't have any reference points here. So it may have absolutely come across like that to her. And who knows, maybe her foster mother was very strict, and maybe she saw something going on that she wanted to help Kathleen through. Kathleen said that harsh punishments were doled out if she was in the wrong, including even being whipped with a belt, which I have to say, I don't know that that's that out of place in the 1970s. Unfortunately, again, it's not correct, but you know, I do think that that was kind of one of the more acceptable forms of corporal punishment, if you will. When Kathleen turned 15, she told her foster mother that she wanted to quit school. Her mother told her that if she dropped out, she would have to move out of the house. And so Kathleen did just that. She quit school, moved in with a friend, and got a job in an Indian restaurant. Not long after, while she and her friend were out dancing, she met Craig Gibson Fulbig, a man 6 years her senior. She fell head over heels for him, and the two married in 1987.
She was how old when she married him?
At this time, I couldn't quite tell, but like 17, 18.
Okay, okay.
So it was a few years after she had moved out, but still very, very young.
Very young.
Very young. During this time, still trying to find her footing, Kathleen would start journaling in what she would call her, quote, babble books, end quote. She found this helped her process her trauma. And when Kathleen came pregnant the next year, she completely changed her lifestyle and really started to work through some things. She began eating healthier. She even made Craig stop smoking. And the two were over the moon when little Caleb Gibson, a full-term healthy baby boy, was born. Soon after Caleb was brought home, his parents noticed that he was a very noisy breather and that he would stop breathing when he was nursing. As a result, the pediatrician diagnosed Caleb with laryngomalacia, or what is commonly known as a floppy larynx. Have you heard of this before?
I have not.
Okay, apparently, it's not common, but it's not super rare either. And it's when the tissues just above the larynx or the voice box are especially soft. And this condition is inherited, and usually babies outgrow it over time. But it causes that kind of soft tissue to fold over a little bit, creating, you know, a bit of difficulty breathing, but it's normally not fatal.
Okay.
Unfortunately, time for Caleb to grow out of it would never come. On February 20th, just 19 days after Caleb was born, Kathleen and Craig put Caleb to sleep in the room next to theirs. They reported that Caleb was restless and awake from midnight to 2 a.m., but seemed to settle down afterwards. When Kathleen went to check on Caleb at 3 a.m., she found him not breathing, but still warm to the touch. Kathleen and Craig called for paramedics, but by the time they arrived, Caleb was gone. The cause of death was listed as sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, which is when an infant, typically under the age of 12 months, dies of an idiopathic cause, or essentially a cause that can't be identified. Just 1 year later, the two would welcome another baby boy into the world, little Patrick Allen. Craig and Kathleen were so concerned with Patrick's health that Craig stayed home from work for the first 3 months of Patrick's life just to help Kathleen. 3 days after Craig returned to work, when Patrick was 4 months old, Craig was awoken by Kathleen's screams. He opened his eyes to see Kathleen standing over Patrick's cot. He found Patrick gasping for air. Emergency services were called, and Patrick was taken to the hospital in respiratory distress.
His condition improved while he was at the hospital, but 2 days into his stay, he had a seizure and was diagnosed with epilepsy and cortical blindness. One of Kathleen's friends remembered her becoming involved with the Royal Blind Society. Her friend said, quote, "She was explaining to me she'd have to teach him to feed himself with a spoon and a fork and a knife, but he wasn't at that age yet," end quote. However, Craig remembers things differently. He said that this incident left Kathleen angry and despondent. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of see that. I mean, you just lost one baby and you're already kind of trying to resolve from the trauma of that, already having your own childhood trauma. And now you have another one that almost died. I can see being a little angry and despondent.
It seems very unfair. And in any time something happens to your child or something affects your child to making their life harder, I can see where a parent might get angry about it.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's the correct response, but I understand it.
Yeah, me too. I mean, they sound like really good parents who really love their kids.
I think they're trying from everything that we can see here.
Right.
Now, because of this, Kathleen would often leave Patrick with her sister-in-law or a neighbor so that she could be alone. To me, this almost sounds like depression as well.
It does. And we know that postpartum depression and even postpartum psychosis are real things that people did not talk about in the 70s and early 80s. And they can really affect a woman's behavior after childbirth.
Yeah, I totally agree. Especially when you've been through this kind of trauma as well.
Right.
One night, Craig found an insert in Kathleen's diary. You remember the babbling books that she had, her babble books?
Cute name, by the way.
Yeah. In it, she had written that she was entertaining the idea of leaving Craig and Patrick. She voiced concerns that they would be better off without her.
Oh, yes. This is depression. This feels very much like postpartum depression.
I agree. Despite the extra care, when Patrick was 8 months old, Kathleen phoned her husband at work screaming, "It's happened again. It's happened again."
Oh, my heart is broken.
Yeah.
I mean, how awful.
Craig rushed home to find first responders in his home. CPR was attempted on Patrick, but was unsuccessful. An autopsy revealed that Patrick had suffered from an acute asphyxiating event resulting from an epileptic fit. His reported cause of death was SIDS.
Mm. Wow, that's unfair.
Yeah. In a 2019 interview conducted with Kathleen by psychologist Michael Diamond, Kathleen admitted that during this time she became depressed, withdrawn, and preoccupied with thoughts of how she'd failed. Diamond said, quote, "She believed she had lived a life of failure. She believed she was not good enough. She recognized these feelings as existing since childhood. She felt she was not a good person," end quote. Following their loss, the couple moved to Thornton, New South Wales. Here, despite her emotional misgivings, Kathleen begged Craig to have another baby.
Oh, wow.
Craig was understandably concerned about a new baby after they had just lost two. He agreed to another baby only if they brought in a SIDS specialist to help them avoid losing a third. Kathleen agreed, and on October 14th, 1992, only a year and a half after Patrick's death, she gave birth to their first daughter, Sarah. Sarah was born a healthy baby girl. The SIDS specialist diagnosed Sarah as having sleep apnea and advised Kathleen to use a sleep apnea mat. Now, are you familiar with these?
So my husband has been diagnosed with sleep apnea.
Okay.
But he doesn't use a mat. He uses like a mask. It's like an elephant.
Well, for infants, these are things, they became popular, well, at least I remember them being popular when I was pregnant, but for us, they weren't mats, but they were like things you could put on the baby's feet, and they were like monitors for like vital signs.
Oh, like the owlet.
Exactly.
Yeah, I had one of those.
Yeah. Okay, so this was kind of like the precursor to those. It was a mat where it would kind of, it would monitor like the breathing, and if the baby was still for too long, it would sound an alarm.
Okay, I was literally envisioning like a machine, like a sleep apnea machine for a baby.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, not like the mask or anything. It literally is like an indicator. So if the baby is still for too long, it'll sound the alarm so you could go in and check on the baby.
Yes, which brought me great relief. Although it also sent me into great panics when we had two false alarms.
Bingo. That is exactly what I wanted you to say because I had the same issue so much so that I stopped using it because
listen, any mother that's going to get this, or father, any parent that's going to get this, is already getting it because they're slightly anxious about their baby not breathing. So when you start getting a bunch of false alarms, like, that doesn't help your anxiety. That creates more anxiety.
It does. And we actually also, with one of my little ones, he got what I would call a burn from it. From
really?
The red light.
Oh, from the laser?
Mm-hmm. And now it didn't seem to bother him in any way, but it freaked me out because he was so little. It's not like he would have been able to tell me.
Right.
And of course, we contacted the company and they said, oh, no, it can happen. You just need to adjust this and that and this and that. And again, it didn't seem to bother him, but it still freaked me out because I thought if it did burn him, it's strapped on him. There's nothing he can do about it. And then afterwards, I did some research and I was like, no, this is a thing. Actually, it can happen. So they are not fail-proof. It did help me sleep. And overall, I would say it was probably a good thing in my situation, but they are definitely not fail-proof.
Well, this experience that you and I both have with these false alarms, it happened with Kathleen and Sarah.
Mm.
So she used this mat for quite a long time because, again, would recommended by the SID specialist. But eventually, the false alarms were stressing her out so much that she said, I can't even use these anymore because I'm just up all the time with these false alarms running in to check on my baby, who's perfectly fine. Now, I would say that Kathleen's probably in this anxious parent category to start with as well.
Rightly so.
Rightly so.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, I know, you're already making the face. Just 3 days after she stopped using the mat, the unthinkable happened again. Craig was woken up by Kathleen screaming. Sarah was not breathing. At 10 months old, Sarah reportedly died of SIDS.
Now, I will say, and I'm not on any side yet, I will say I do find it interesting that it twice now has been either as soon as she was left alone with the baby or as soon as she stopped using XYZ. That's just interesting that things are going wrong as soon as these scenarios start happening.
And also, I find it interesting all those stories that she's the one waking up Craig.
Like, okay.
Maybe she's just the primary caretaker.
Well, and first thought was, oh, it's interesting. She's always the one that finds them. But then I thought, you know what? I would have been the
one
because my husband worked outside the home
and
I stayed home. So in the middle of the night, I'm the one who's, first of all, going to respond to them if there's something wrong. But also, I'm also the anxious one. So I was the one who was up checking on them.
Right.
Making sure they're breathing.
Right. Now, the death of their third baby put a tremendous amount of strain on Kathleen and Craig, and their marriage really suffered. I mean, I can't even imagine.
Oh, it's just unthinkable. It truly is.
The two wound up separating. And they came back together. It's actually happened a few times. But eventually, their formal reconciliation led to their fourth baby.
I don't even want to know what happened because I don't have good feelings about it. And the fact that they keep reconciling tells me they really loved each other.
I think it's that's probably true. Or so they just trauma. Had a toxic codependency.
That's true. They could also,
I don't know which one, but
be
it's
very
one of the
trauma
two.
Bonded.
Yeah, trauma bonded, right? The couple moved again in 1996 and gave birth to Laura on August 7th, 1997. Laura was born a healthy baby girl with only mild sleep apnea, but sleep apnea nonetheless.
So I guess it's genetic, maybe? I have to assume.
Well,
I guess we're going to find out.
Yeah. At this point, we're just trying to keep Laura here.
Oh,
right?
Man. Okay.
She was tested extensively for any genetic or metabolic conditions, but none were found. And you can imagine why the doctors were like, why don't we go ahead and cover all those bases?
Sure.
Right? A SIDS expert, again, suggested a sleep mat for the full Biggs baby. And again, Kathleen used it until the false alarms steered her away from its usage.
You know what? At this point, though, I think I may have. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on how often the false alarms are going off. But at this point, after losing three babies, I might just go with the false alarms. Honestly, these have also been proven to give a false sense of security. That's also the downside of these.
Yeah.
But still.
Well, I will say Craig felt the way that you did.
Okay.
I mean, he was disturbed by the fact that she was not using the sleep apnea mat anymore.
Okay.
And he confronted her about it. She explained that she was keeping a, quote, close eye on Laura, and Craig shouldn't worry.
Okay.
I don't know that I would have that much faith in myself if I had already lost three babies.
The baby would be in like bubble wrap. I would never sleep.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be really unhealthy.
Yes, I believe that's true.
Situation. But I haven't lived through this, so we'll see what she ends up doing.
Unfortunately, Craig saw some other concerning things. He found Kathleen to be a little disconnected from Laura. She'd easily get frustrated with her. Kathleen would also spend much of her time at the gym, where Laura stayed in the nursery. And when Laura was almost 2 years old, she's lived to two.
Okay, so it's no longer going to be SIDS. Now, there is, I guess, a toddler equivalent of SIDS. I can't remember what
right,
it's
but
called.
SIDS is definitely the much more common one.
Right, and right. It's under the age of 12 months.
Correct, typically. Right. So when Laura was almost 2 years old, Kathleen and Laura visited Craig at work in the morning and then headed home around 11:30 for lunch. At 12:15, Kathleen would call an ambulance, saying that her daughter wasn't breathing. First responders arrived to find Kathleen performing CPR on Laura, who had no pulse but was still warm to the touch. Unfortunately, Laura would not recover. An autopsy revealed mild myocarditis, which is a swelling in the heart, but it was not considered severe enough to have caused her death. Because of this, and her age, which as you said, she's older than 12 months, the cause of death was not reported as SIDS, like the other three babies, but rather as undetermined.
Okay.
After the loss of their fourth child, Craig was beside himself with confusion and grief and anger, and he and Kathleen decided to split up for good. And while Craig was collecting some of Kathleen's belongings to help her put them in boxes, he happened to pick up some of her journals. And he was curious, and so he started leafing through some of the journals. What he read shocked and devastated him. And here, for me, is where the story kind of takes on a life of its own. I mean, everything prior to this is just tragedy, complete tragedy.
Sure.
But this is where you kind of start to put some flesh on it. And I will tell you, so much of what I'm about to share with you, which are excerpts from the journal, can be interpreted in many different ways. So I'm just going to read through them.
Okay.
And then you can give me your opinion of where it lies.
Okay.
On June 3rd of 1990, the day Kathleen's second child, Patrick, was born, she wrote, quote, "This was the day that Patrick Allen David Fulbig was born. I had mixed feelings this day, whether or not I was going to cope as a mother or whether I was going to get stressed out like I did the last time. I often regret Caleb and Patrick, only because your life changes so much, and maybe I'm not a person that likes change. But we will see." On June 18th, 1996, before she became pregnant with her fourth child, she wrote, "I'm ready this time. I know I'll have help and support this time. When I think I'm going to lose control like last time, I'll just hand the baby over to someone else. I've learned my lesson this time."
Okay, that actually literally sent chills down my spine or down my arms. And I will tell you, I have a lot of sympathy for women because I suffered from postpartum anxiety, not depression, but anxiety and crazy nutso stuff. Would literally do like 3 times daily perimeter checks around my house to make sure no sinkholes were opening up because I was just terrified a sinkhole was going to open up and swallow my baby, which now sounds insane. In those moments seemed very real. I share that to tell you, first of all, if you are having crazy thoughts like that postpartum, you're not alone. But because I know that hormones and these chemicals can really alter your brain and affect you. So I am very sympathetic to women going through postpartum issues. That being said, that sent chills down my arm.
I agree with everything that you said.
Okay. Continue.
Yeah. 4 months later, again, this is still before she's pregnant with Laura, she wrote, quote, "Children thing still isn't happening. Thinking of forgetting the idea. Nature, fate, and the man upstairs have decided I don't get a fourth chance. And rightly so, I supposed. I would like to make all my mistakes and terrible thinking be corrected and mean something, though. Plus, I'm ready to continue my family time now. Obviously, I'm my father's daughter. Pause. But I think the losing my temper stage and being frustrated with everything has passed. I now just let things happen and go with the flow. An attitude I should have had with all my children. If given the chance, I'll have it with the next one. On December 4th, 1996, she found out she was pregnant again with her fourth child, Laura. She wrote, quote, I'm ready this time, but I've already decided if I get any feelings of jealousy or anger too much, I will leave Craig and baby rather than answer being as before. Silly, but will be the only way I can cope. These don't bode well.
No, and I can understand, like, as mothers, we all have those moments where we're tired and newborn babies are hard and you want to sleep. And sometimes you get mad. I remember just being like, please just sleep, like, and getting frustrated. So even all of that is normal. But this has a tone that seems beyond that.
I agree with you. Just a few weeks later, she wrote, quote, another year gone and what a year to come. I have a baby on the way, which means major personal sacrifice for both of us. But I feel confident about it going well. This time, I'm going to call for help. This time, I'll not attempt to do everything myself anymore. I know that that was the main reason for all my stress before, and stress made me do terrible things. In February of 1996, she wrote, quote, still can't sleep. Seem to be thinking of Patrick and Sarah and Caleb. Makes me genuinely wonder whether I am stupid or doing the right thing by having this baby. My guilt of how responsible I feel for them all haunts me. My fear of it happening again haunts me. What scares me most is when I'm alone with baby. How do I overcome that? Defeat that. On October 25th, 1997, when Laura was about 2 months old, so now she's had the baby, Laura's 2 months old, Kathleen wrote, quote, I cherish Laura more. I miss her, as in Sarah, yes, but I'm not sad that Laura is here and she isn't. Is that a bad way to think? I don't know. I think I'm more patient with Laura. I take the time to figure out what's wrong now instead of just snapping my cog. Wouldn't have handled another one like Sarah. She has saved her life by being different.
Stephanie, I mean, I want to give this poor woman the benefit of the doubt because no matter what, I think there's postpartum issues going on. Mm-hmm. Like, I definitely think that we've got some things that are probably out of her control. But my question to myself is, did those cause her to do bad mm-hmm. things?
Yeah. 4 days later, she wrote, quote, felt a little angry towards Laura today. It was because I am and was very tired. She doesn't push my buttons anywhere near the extent Sarah did. Luck is good for her is all I can say. End quote. In a further diary entry when Laura was 3 months old, on November 9th, 1997, Kathleen wrote, quote, Craig has a morbid fear about Laura. Well, I know there's nothing wrong with her. Nothing out of the ordinary anyway. Because it was me, not them. With Sarah, all I wanted was her to shut up. And one day she did. End quote.
I have no words. I have no words. I'm so sad for Craig having to read this.
Devastating. I heard when he read it, he said he vomited.
You would. You absolutely would. I mean, not only have you lost your children, but now you're seeing this and oh no, it's just too much.
Later of Laura, Kathleen wrote, lost it with her earlier, left her crying in our bedroom and had to walk out. That feeling was happening, and I think it's because I had to clear my head and prioritize as I've done here now. I love her. I really do. I don't want anything to happen. On New Year's Eve, 1997, when Laura again was 4 months old, quote, getting Laura to next year ought to be fun. She'll realize a party is going on, and that will be it. I wonder if the battle of wills will start with her then. We'll actually get to see. She's a fairly good-natured baby. Thank goodness. It has saved her from the fate of her siblings. I think she was warned. End quote.
Okay, so that's the part that's not normal. Like that, I mean, that's the part that's like, I mean, how warned do you explain that what? Away? How do you explain that away? Her good nature, the fact that she's an easy baby has saved her from her sibling's fate. How do you explain that any other way than I lost my patience and
so
got rid of them?
I will say, when I first read all of these quotes, I felt exactly the same way that you did. The more I looked at them, I really tried to look at them as an overwhelmed mother who has had trauma. And I feel like Kathleen thinks she is the evil that is making her children die. If you're going to say she's not, she did not intentionally harm them.
Okay.
I think she feels when she gets angry at them, she's being punished by having them taken away.
You know what? That is absolutely a valid point. It's so.
And so when you read these, it really truly is. It depends on what lens you view it through, because I can absolutely see how you would read this and say she murdered her children.
Right.
I can absolutely see how you could look through this and say she's a woman who feels so incapable of caring for her children that universe, God, whatever it is punishing her because she's a terrible person because she got angry at her children.
It's true. It's true. I can see it that way.
And again, point I that out. See that until I read right. them several times.
Right.
Now, on January 18th, she said, quote, "I've done it. I've lost it with her. I yelled at her so angrily that it scared her. She hasn't stopped crying. Got so bad I nearly purposely dropped her on the floor and left her. I restrained enough to put her on the floor and walk away. Went to my room and left her to cry. Was gone probably only 5 minutes, but it seemed like a lifetime. I feel like the worst mother on this earth. Scared she will leave me now, like Sarah did. I know I was short-tempered and cruel sometimes to her, and she left with a bit of help. I didn't want that to ever happen again. I actually seem to have a bond with Laura. I can't happen again. I'm ashamed of myself. I can't tell Craig about it because he'll worry about leaving her with me. It only seems to happen if I'm too tired of her moaning, bored, whiny sounds which drive me up the wall. I truly can't wait till she's old enough to tell me what she wants." End quote.
So that last passage I tried listening to through the lens that you just suggested. It still seems very angry.
I agree. I don't disagree. Truly. And Detective Sergeant Bernard Bryan, as we'll see, kind of agreed with you. Now, he was assigned to investigate Laura's death, and it came across as death because it was an undetermined death.
Sure.
And he very easily could have just attributed Laura's death to, like, the older form of SIDS. But something kind of just made his spidey sense go off, and he started looking at the whole picture and saw there were three children before her that had also died of SIDS. And with the ruling of undetermined, he just wanted to look a little bit more into it. So he decided to do an interview with both Kathleen and Craig just to get some more information. And in his interview with Craig, Craig presented these journals.
So Craig didn't find them and immediately go to authorities with them. But
I think it was already in the works, this interview, and he brought them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, once you introduce the journals, I mean, it would be a very open-minded person to not place full responsibility on her, quite frankly.
Well, and at this point, Craig is completely convinced of her guilt, too.
Which, how?
I get it. If nothing else, you just want to place blame somewhere. Right.
True. We've talked before. Like, sometimes you just want somebody to blame. I don't know that I would want to have to blame my spouse, but I mean, ugh.
Right. And essentially, as soon as Detective Bryan got these journals, because he wanted to solve something too, but he didn't have anything to go on. But as soon as Craig said, "Hey, I found these journals," that was it.
It's not looking good.
It's not looking good. Now, Detective Bryan took 2 years to assemble a case against Kathleen Fulbig. He wanted to make sure if they were going to prosecute that it would be something that would stick.
Which I always admire.
Absolutely.
Doing the work.
Yeah. Right. On April 19th, 2001, Kathleen was arrested at her home, taken into custody, and charged with murdering her four children. During her bail hearing at Maitland Local Court,
Police prosecutor Daniel Mayer told the court that the prosecution would show evidence from Kathleen's own diaries, technical evidence from pathology experts, and testimony from her estranged husband to prove that she had killed her children. While each child's individual death had not raised much concern, Mayer told the court their collective deaths could only be attributed to suffocation.
Okay. I mean, that sounds valid to me.
Yeah. He said the circumstances surrounding the deaths were not consistent with sudden infant death syndrome. This included the fact that the children were found face up. They were still warm when found. And in two cases, there were signs of life.
Correct. You're right. You know what? I didn't even like think of that, but you're right. That doesn't present like SIDS.
Right. The prosecution's case presented evidence in the case of each child that would have precluded them from the category of death by SIDS and instead related their deaths to strangulation. Much attention was also drawn to Kathleen's preoccupation with her looks, specifically her weight. They said she was resentful of her children as they interfered with her time at the gym and her sleep. And then there were the damning confessions in her diary, combined with witness testimony from Craig. He recounted the times when Kathleen lost her temper with Laura. He related the details of each baby's death and described the terrifying growl that Kathleen would produce when she got frustrated with the children. Nurses were brought in that testified that Kathleen seemed detached from her children. The Crown prosecutors also said they had, quote, run extensive tests that had ruled out the possibility that the children suffered fatal genetic or viral disorders, end quote. The defense, led by lawyer Peter Zara, refuted the claim that the cause of death had not been SIDS and based their argument on the fact that the children had all been sick prior to their deaths. He framed Kathleen as being an overwhelmed mother that was suffering from confusion and guilt. On May 21st, 2003, 2 months after the trial began, the verdict was read. Kathleen Fulbig was guilty of 3 counts of murder, 1 count of manslaughter, and 1 count of maliciously inflicting grievous bodily harm. On October 24th, 2003, Kathleen was sentenced to 40 years imprisonment with no possibility of parole for 30 years. After the verdict, Craig Fulbig spoke to a reporter through tears. He said, quote, "My humble thanks go to 12 people whom I have never formally met, who today share the honor of having helped set 4 beautiful souls free, free to rest in peace, finally," end quote. During most of her time in incarceration, Kathleen had lived in protective isolation, as women in prison can be violent towards women who kill children, especially their own children. Now, I know that you are like a prison boss.
Well, yes.
But you're the prison cool girl.
I'm the cool girl.
So you can, you know, shed some light on this for me.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, I have never been to prison. Just for the record.
Just wants to be.
What episode was that? Escape from Alcatraz.
Oh, the Escape from Alcatraz.
Yeah, yeah. Listen to Escape from Alcatraz and you'll know what we're talking about.
Oh, you just didn't want me to leave it like that?
Let's clarify, you know. If I went to prison, I'm pretty sure I'd be the cool girl, is what I said.
Pretty sure. But if I'm not, I'm in big trouble.
Deep trouble, which we all know I'd be in deep trouble. But didn't one of our listeners write in and be like, yeah, no, she wouldn't make it.
She's not going to make it.
Thanks a lot for that, listener, by the way.
On January 1st, 2021, Kathleen was transferred to a new prison and severely beaten by other inmates. So that's 2021.
I mean, recent.
Yeah. So like decades had passed.
Yeah.
Like her reputation still
preceded her.
Exactly. Since she was transferred, she still wound up getting beat.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, wasn't her first baby like 19 days old?
Yeah.
The idea of strangling any of your children, no matter their age, but specifically 19 days. I mean, come on.
Oh, absolutely. It's unfathomable.
Right.
Incredibly, though, just a few months after her transfer, a petition signed by over 100 scientists urged the governor to reopen Kathleen's case based on new genetic evidence that showed that babies were carriers of a genetic mutation that made them susceptible to sudden cardiac arrest and death.
That's really wild. 100 scientists are signing this petition.
Yeah.
Saying, hold up, there could be a reasonable explanation.
Yeah, this many years after her conviction, too.
Wow.
The researchers concluded that the CALM2 mutation, so that's CALM2 mutation, which was carried by Kathleen, Sarah, and Laura, altered their heart rhythm, predisposing them to sudden, unexpected death, especially if there was an additional illness.
And they'd all been sick.
Yes. Sarah had a small cold right before she died, and Laura had that mild myocarditis in her, that they found in her autopsy.
Wow. Okay.
Now, mutations on the CALM2 occur in approximately 1 out of every 35 million individuals. So the fact that there's 3 in 1 family, so Kathleen has it, Sarah had it, and Laura had it.
And this is confirmed. They've confirmed in the autopsy or however that they all definitely were. It's a very rare mutation, but if you're a carrier,
right,
and then the odds are obviously much higher that your children might have it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Caleb and Patrick each carried 2 potentially lethal genetic mutations in the gene BSN. It's this very complicated name. I'm going to try it. It's Bassoon Presynaptic Cytomatics Protein.
Oh, yes. I'm an expert on
that. So we're just going to refer to it as BSN. But it's linked to early onset lethal epilepsy in mice, with 1 mutation inherited from their mother and the second one likely inherited from their father, Craig. Patrick had epileptic seizures prior to his death.
Right.
Right. And Caleb, again, he passed away when he was 19 days old. So who knows how that presented. On June 5th, 2023, so not even a year ago, after 20 years in prison for killing her 4 babies, Kathleen Fulbig was released from prison. And on December 14th, 2023, the court invalidated her previous convictions, finding that there was reasonable doubt of her guilt.
I will tell you, her journal entries still bother me, but this is definitely reasonable doubt.
It definitely is. But that doesn't mean necessarily that she's innocent.
No, but it's reasonable doubt.
It absolutely is reasonable doubt.
It is another explanation, another possibility of what could have happened. Yeah. I mean, it's just a possibility of it's an explanation of what could have happened to each of these children.
It absolutely is. So I fully believe that these 4 children had the genetic mutation that these scientists are saying they had. However, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the reason that they died.
True. That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Because the odds still are very great that all 4 of your children are going to die. I mean, what are the odds of that? And from different. Okay, I get it. We have a genetic mutation here that, you know, puts you at risk, but it's not even all the same.
Right.
It's not even all the same. Yeah.
Right. So it's a lot. Out of her 4 children, 2 of them had completely separate genetic mutations.
Right.
That took their life in infancy. It's a little out there.
It is.
You know, is it possible? Sure. And I mean, and maybe you're able to interpret all those journal entries as being from a overwhelmed, insecure, frustrated mother. But they're angry, too. They just seem a little pointed.
It is very hard. And again, I'm feeling I'm pretty sympathetic. And I also think that, you know what? There were times when I was angry as a new mom. I remember one time specifically where I just hadn't slept in days and I was just like, you know, I felt like I was crazy because this child just never wanted to sleep.
Oh, there was definitely a moment I remember when I was like, I am the worst mother in the world, or he deserves a better mother than me.
Right.
Of course.
You're angry at your husband because you look over at him and he's just snoozing away, or you're angry at, you know, the fact that why isn't my baby sleeping? I mean, all of those feelings are completely real. I personally never felt what Kathleen appears had been feeling. Like, I never, that's pretty dark.
Well, and I don't think anybody can put
themselves in her shoes. No one has lost 4 infants.
That alone would make you angry.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, you would be angry.
I think there may be someone out there that has, I mean, God forbid, been through this. But I mean, I don't know many people that can even relate with her mindset. I mean, just her start alone with her father murdering her mother and then being shuffled around to homes. I mean, that already is starting you out to not be able to emotionally process things very well.
Right.
And then you've been through, I mean, truly losing a child's the worst thing that could happen. And then to lose multiple children. Very, I don't know. It's dicey. I don't know how I feel about this.
And to be dealing with what I feel is obviously some kind of postpartum depression or psychosis or something. So you've got that, which is already a really difficult thing.
Absolutely.
Plus the loss of children, which is just unspeakable. And then as you said, multiple children. I guess, you know what? Yeah, I might be in a really dark place. I might be writing some really scary things. I mean, what a horrible life.
Yeah.
Honestly.
And there were several other journal entries that I didn't put in here, but a lot of them pertain to her being very insecure about her relationship with Craig. Like, if I don't look good, he's going to leave me, or I need to get back in the gym because I need to be a smoking hot wife. And so there were a lot of insecurities there too about the possibility of Craig leaving her, and she needs to be the perfect mother and the perfect wife, and she needs to look the part. And so a lot of pressure she put on herself. But again, did that pressure just make her an overwhelmed, stressed mom, or did that make her snap where she harmed her children?
Well, and I can see if those types of entries were shared with a jury, that could make her sound like, you know, your child died and you're worried about how you look. But quite frankly, like, so it could make her seem, you know, unsympathetic.
And remember, those things were brought up in her trial.
Right.
She was so concerned with her looks. But I can see that too as being a mom.
It's the one thing she can control.
I know.
It's the one thing. As a mother, we know we give up so much of ourselves. I feel like there are maybe like 3 things in my life that are like me, the old me.
Yeah.
This podcast being one of them. And everything else, you know, it has gone to my children and my family. And I'm not complaining. It's
as
wonderful.
Kathleen said, personal sacrifice.
Right. But so if the way she looked and the way she felt about how she looked was something that made her feel like the old her, or the one thing she could control in a life that is obviously full of things that are out of our control, I can see it. Yeah, I'm torn.
I know, but could it have been to the point where she wanted her freedom and her body and her life back so much that she would have harmed her children in order to get it?
I mean, that's the question, right?
Yeah.
Every single one, I could be like, yeah, I can see that.
I know.
Every single option that's been presented. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, since Kathleen's release from prison, she's been bombarded with requests for interviews, right?
Like,
I want to pick her brain. Like, what is going on?
Right.
And many questions clearly surround these journal entries. And her responses are pretty simple. Quote, those diaries are written from a point of me always blaming myself. I blamed myself for everything. I took so much of the responsibility because that's, as mothers, what you do. End quote.
Oh, you know what, though? I feel that. I feel that to my core. Anytime there is any kind of anything that doesn't meet my expectations when it comes to my children, who do I blame? Me.
Of course, they died because I did not take care of them properly, or I am a bad person, so they're being taken from me.
Right. Or even little things like, you know, they had a temper tantrum. Well, obviously, I didn't teach them how to behave better.
Yeah.
I didn't give them the tools. I mean, that's what we do as mothers.
Yeah. So I find Kathleen to be so relatable and so untouchable all at the same time. Like the things I know of her, you know what I mean? Like there are so many things I can't relate to her about, but at the same time, like you said, I feel what she says.
I feel a lot of what she says. Yeah, absolutely.
As for her exoneration, Kathleen told reporters, quote, for almost a quarter of a century, I faced disbelief and hostility. I suffered abuse in all its forms. I hoped and prayed that one day I would be able to stand here with my name cleared. I am grateful that updated science and genetics have given me answers to how my children died, end quote.
Can you imagine in a world that she's not responsible?
Yeah.
And she just lived through that awful tragedy 4 different times. And then she's convicted of the murder of her children, loses her husband. Her husband thinks she's guilty of murdering her children. I mean, that's just,
you know,
almost too terrible to even think about.
It's too terrible to must think about. The other one is she murdered 4 children and now is a free woman.
Also really terrible to think about. Stephanie, I don't know what to think of this.
I know. This is why I had to cover it.
Now, I will say, the fact that she was exonerated, people must have felt very, very strongly.
Well, and that's true. She wasn't just pardoned. She was completely exonerated. So, you know, her original release from prison, there was still the condition of she was released, but she had served time. You know, they could have parsed this a couple of different ways, but they gave her a complete pardon. They erased all charges.
Which it says a lot.
A big deal.
That's a big
deal. So I do lean more towards that perspective because people much smarter than me have looked into this case. But again, reasonable doubt doesn't mean she didn't have part in it, or maybe even not all of them, but one of them. I don't know.
Wow. I mean, I really don't know. I really don't know. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. The whole case is just completely tragic. Let's just put that under the umbrella. I mean, oh,
it's
the entire
awful no matter
awful.
What happened. It's awful. Yeah. I mean, it's awful. It's awful. I don't know which is more awful. I don't know if it's more awful to think that she murdered her children or if it's more awful to think that her 4 babies were stolen from her and she has to survive that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, add on 20 years of prison.
Yeah. So I've chosen this as our branch of hope case because we need to help some kids with childhood illnesses.
Wow.
And that's what we're doing with this case because it's a heavy one. But man, if we had been able to get these genetic tests prior to the investigation, prior to her conviction, we would have known the answer right away and would have been spared. She would have been spared decades of this process. And that's what I'm really hoping we can do. We've decided to pair with Translational Genomics Research Institute, or TGen, and they are an Arizona-based nonprofit medical research institute, which is dedicated to conducting groundbreaking research with what they call life-changing results. And I do believe this. They work to unravel the genetic components of common and complex diseases, including cancer, neurological diseases, infectious disease, and rare childhood disorders. By identifying treatment options, they believe medicine becomes more rational, more precise, more personal. And we want to continue the mission of uncovering childhood diseases so that stories like Catherine may be again resolved before they become the subject of scrutiny and more pain. A portion of proceeds from our Patreon and sponsors will go towards TGen this month. If you want to participate, please head to our website or our social media platforms where you can find out how to donate directly. And you can also join our Patreon, where a portion of your subscription funds go into this Branch of Hope Foundation nonprofit fund. Again, we do this because the true stories we tell in this podcast provide entertainment and excitement, but we always want to show compassion and respect to the victims and their loved ones. The Branch of Hope Fund allows us to give back to the community, spread awareness about unsolved cases, and hopefully bring a little comfort and hope to those who need it.
I feel really passionate about this nonprofit you've chosen. I have more than one friend whose lives have been touched by genetic issues and have lost children because of genetic issues. And to think that we might be able to do something in the future that can keep other families from experience those types of tragedy.
Certainly.
I just can't think of anything better.
I totally agree. I felt really strongly. I love talking about Kathleen Fulbig and her story, and then also this nonprofit that goes along with it that I feel really strongly about.
Yeah, they're doing really good work. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, as always, we are simply a podcast leading through words and actions. If you loved this episode, love us, or love what we are doing at the Branch of Hope Foundation, please like and subscribe and tell someone. Forward this episode to a friend who might like it. And send us an email at thedarkoakpodcast@gmail.com. We are open to your questions, your comments, and anything else that you want to share. And for other ways to connect, hop over to thedarkoak.com.
Be sure to follow us to our next episode where we cover the suspicious death of Keith Warren. Thanks for listening, Shiver Seekers. You guys rock.
Bye.
Bye. This episode of The Dark Oak was created, researched, written, recorded, hosted, edited, published, and marketed by Cynthia and Stephanie of Just Us Gals Productions, and made possible by you, our shiver-seeking listener. Special thanks goes to Justice Himes for our incredible artwork and Ryan Crete for our amazing music.